Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now is Manhattan DA Cy Vance, just reelected for a third term, having run unopposed except for a last-minute write-in campaign by a former Brooklyn sex crimes prosecutor. As many of you know, that came because of two news reports about Vance in the weeks before the election, one by WNYC and ProPublica about Vance overruling his own team's suggestion that they prosecute Donald Jr. and Ivanka Trump in connection with misleading and conspiring to mislead prospective buyers of units at Trump Soho. The other revelation was about Vance's non-indictment of Harvey Weinstein after the NYPD caught Weinstein on tape, apparently admitting what sounds to many people like sexual assault. DA Vance declined to be interviewed by us before the election, but is in our studio now with his side of these two stories. And we'll talk about other things, too, like Vance sounding the alarm about an NRA-supported bill in Congress that would basically force New York City to adopt, say, Texas's concealed carry gun policy as our own whenever someone from Texas or another concealed carry state is here, and Vance's recommendation as part of a task force just adopted by New York State's chief judge that would force prosecutors to turn over evidence they have that's helpful to the defense. That would be to avoid wrongful convictions. DA Vance, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Let's clear the air on these two stories, and then we can move on to your third term. In the Trump case, our reporting says that ultimately you overruled your own prosecutors in deciding not to bring charges. True?
Not true. Let me give you the background. The Trump investigation was an investigation that was started in 2010 after a civil suit had been filed by investors who wanted to purchase hotel rooms in the Trump Soho. We opened an investigation. The investigation went on with counsel for the subjects, the Trump children and other investors, for about a year. About a year into the case, the investors who claimed that they had been defrauded through their lawyer sent us a letter indicating that they did not believe, in fact, that they were the victims of crime and that they would not cooperate in the case going forward unless they were subpoenaed by court order. At that point, I permitted the investigation to continue for roughly another 8 months. And at the end of that period, I had to make a judgment call as we were coming on the two-year mark whether or not there was a criminal case that can and should be brought.
Did some of your prosecutors recommend that that case be brought?
There were some prosecutors who felt there was sufficient proof to go forward, and there were others who felt there was not. And ultimately, I'm a lawyer who has had 20 years trial experience doing white-collar criminal defense. I felt I had a good sense for the strength of the evidence. And quite honestly, I also was concerned about where I was spending our office resources. I have about 100,000 cases a year. I have 100,000 victims who actually think they're victims and want to have our office proceed. In this case, they were sophisticated investors with sophisticated lawyers who decided that they were no longer or did not believe they were victims. And ultimately, I made the decision that while I recognize that some in my office felt the evidence was there, I and others thought it wasn't. And some people went back and forth during the many months of the investigation. So ultimately, I made a judgment call. I think it was the right judgment call. And the case started as a civil case. It was settled by the parties as a civil case. And I believed it should end as a civil case.
The emails reported on had Donald Jr. and Ivanka acknowledging that they were presenting false information and discussing how to coordinate presenting that false information to prospective buyers. If that description of their emails is accurate, why is that not some kind of criminal conspiracy to commit fraud?
Well, first of all, it's easy to say, I hear there was emails and they were talking about inflating figures, therefore there's a crime and should be brought. The standard that we have in every criminal case, Brian, is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that is a standard that means it's a very high standard. So it's not just what the court of public opinion feels about it in 7 years later. It's what the evidence is at the time. There's no doubt that there were emails that were damning to a certain degree, but there's also no doubt that the very people who said they were victims believed that stated that they were not defrauded. And honestly, I thought that the case, we had spent 2 years on a case. It had not improved. The quality of the evidence has not improved. I'd given the team plenty of time to look into it. And ultimately, I made the call, guided by, both the team and many meetings that we'd had with them. And I think the team understood my decision.
There's also the highly unusual sequence of campaign donations reported in that story, in which Donald Trump Sr.'s attorney, Mr. Kasowitz, gave your campaign $25,000 before he asked for a meeting on this case. He got the meeting, but in conjunction with that, you returned the money. But then after you granted his meeting and then dropped the case, he donated $50,000. Now, this has the appearance of doubling his money as a thank you gift. How should the public think of his and your roles in these transactions?
I want to state, Brian, unequivocally that, and will explain, I believe, or I hope I can, why there has never been any case that I have worked on that was influenced in any way, shape, or form by a campaign contribution by a donor. That has been the way I've operated as DA in my 7 years, and I believe it is the way the office operates. The laws in New York, which is not known to many people, permit donations to be given by lawyers, even who have cases where they are appearing in the office. That is a perfectly legal and permissible donation. But I will say, Brian, that I had a blind spot. Because it was permissible and legal, because it's common practice among district attorneys all over the country, because lawyers are the folks who actually know them best and contribute to them, I did not perceive that those dollars which were taken in would someday be looked at as influencing my decision making. So I, first of all, that was my blind spot. And I think in today's environment, there's a lot of anger. There's anger about abuse of authority in government. There's anger about abuse of authority, men over women. And in that context, I think that what I need to do is to take advantage of this moment where the public has raised real concerns, acknowledge that those concerns should be, I should do something about those concerns in order to make sure the public maintains a level of trust in the work of our prosecutors in my office.
And I understand what you're saying is that the blind spot was the appearance of impropriety. And I think the least thing that anybody is suspicious of you for in either of these stories is that you are bought. So I'm curious, because my understanding is that that kind of donation is so unusual, for the context of understanding our president and his family, is it uniquely a Trump way of doing business in your experience?
I've listened to you, I've read the newspapers, and I don't simply know really enough about how the Trumps do business. But what I can say is that those amounts of money were large in that case, but they are not. There were other donations by other individuals at the same amount. The main thing is this is an opportunity for me to take advantage and eliminate this blind spot in our practices in the office, which is why I've asked the Columbia Center for the Advancement of Public Integrity to come in and do a review, make recommendations to me. I expect that the recommendations will result in substantial changes to the way that we do fundraising in our office, whether attorneys who have cases before the office should be permitted to contribute. We should explore a public finance district attorney's campaign, and it'll be interesting to see what they recommend, and I look forward to it.
Manhattan DA Cy Vance, our guest on WNYC. And now the Weinstein case, the incident in 2015 where the model Amber Batalana Gutierrez had an encounter with Weinstein at his hotel room that involved, at very least, him admitting touching her breast, and she reported it to the NYPD. So she recorded an encounter the next day, again at his hotel room. Here's just 14 seconds of that much longer NYPD video. It's a little hard to hear, listeners. This begins with her asking, why yesterday you touched my breast?
Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on. Sit here. Sit here for a minute, please.
So why isn't that Weinstein admitting to criminal sexual contact the day before.
The tape is disgusting, and it is disturbing by any observation. When this incident came into our office, I assigned it to be investigated by Martha Bashford, who is the chief of our sex crimes unit. She has 38 years experience in sex crimes and currently is the congressionally appointed chairwoman of a committee to investigate sexual assaults in the military nationally. Martha conducted a detailed investigation. At the end of that investigation, she had reviewed materials that went far beyond the 14 seconds of the tape, but a deep investigation of all the circumstances surrounding it. And much of that information is not public and won't be public. And that is the nature, particularly, of sex crime investigations. And that is very frustrating to the public, and it's also frustrating to me. At the end of the day, Martha made a recommendation that I understood after she explained it, that we were not going to be able to prevail in this case at trial for a number of reasons. And therefore, the decision was made that we would not prosecute the case. And that is why that happened. But it was vetted by one of the most experienced sex crimes prosecutors in the country. And her decision was unbiased and was based on the evidence. I operate in a court of law, not one of public opinion. And so we have to be mindful of what the evidence actually will show.
But to the evidence, your office sent us an email highlighting a section of the law that says to prove either crime, forcible touching or third-degree sexual abuse, the state must show the accused person touched someone to degrade them or for sexual gratification, not some other purpose. So why is that tape not basically an admission by Weinstein that he touched Ms. Gutierrez's breast for sexual gratification against her will? What other plausible reason could the defense have come up with for his touching her in that way?
Brian, the answer to that question lies in the factual investigation that I can't share. And I'm not trying to be mysterious, but we have to take seriously our obligations to keep confidential information that even the public doesn't understand why it should be confidential. At the end of the day, the question was, what happened in that hotel room? Did that conduct violate the elements of the statute beyond a reasonable doubt? The investigation by the chief of the sex crimes unit determined that it did not, and that was why the decision was made.
Let's take a phone call. Kate in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Manhattan DA Cy Vance. Hello, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I saw the film Abacus on Frontline recently, and it's very powerful. It left me with this lingering question about really why the big banks weren't prosecuted when obviously this smaller, immigrant family bank in Chinatown went through that prosecution process. Why were the more egregious, issues related to the financial crisis not being prosecuted?
Did you watch the movie Abacus, the documentary?
No, I haven't watched the documentary, but I think I know the players.
Which basically suggests that you went after a bank that was, they called it small enough to fail, rather than challenging the ones that are, small enough to jail, rather than the ones that are too big to fail.
Right. The Abacus case was not an investigation that we started out of thin air. There was a complaint by one of the mortgage holders of the bank that there were improprieties going on in the bank. At the end of that case, which I went on for about a year and a half, ultimately, I think seven employees of Abacus pleaded guilty to fraud in their bank operations. There was a criminal trial. It lasted a long time. The jury was out for like 10 days, and they were and at the end of the day, it was a lengthy case where many employees pleaded guilty, and the jury decided, as juries decide, whether evidence was proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So that was a case that really came in as an ordinary complaint by a citizen, and that we investigated.
It brings up this whole issue of behavior toward the powerful as opposed to the less powerful. There was an op-ed in the Times just last month with respect to this, and you And it said, for example, as of 2015, Mr. Vance was more likely to prosecute a misdemeanor charge than any other district attorney in New York City. And despite lamenting racism in the criminal justice system, Mr. Vance perpetuates worrisome racial disparities. A 2014 Vera Institute of Justice study found that Black and Latino defendants prosecuted by Mr. Vance's office were more likely to be detained at booking compared with similarly situated white defendants. And last year, 51% of marijuana cases involving Black defendants in Manhattan ended in conviction, while only 23% involving whites did. Are the stats accurate?
Well, let's just start first with the allegation. It was me who asked the Vera Institute of Justice to come into our office and conduct a racial bias review of the charging, plea bargaining, bail, and sentencing recommendations of our office. It was a long process, but I felt that it was essential that the DA of Manhattan be able to talk more transparently about its own practices before I was called on to criticize other practices. What I would say, Brian, is that in the aftermath of that Vera report, I was trying to find ways to make sure that we were only bringing people into the system for whom there was a real need to bring them in, and that was more likely to involve young men and women of color, because those are the individuals who are most arrested. And as a result of that work, we have now reduced the number of cases that we prosecute, misdemeanors and violations, much of which you'd call quality of life, from about 90,000 in 2016 down to about 55 or 6,000 today. So roughly 28 to 33% reduction in the number of cases, in minor cases and misdemeanor cases. So that is the direct product of the Vera report, where my focus was how can we change the picture of who we are bringing into the system, how can we right-size it, how can we get better outcomes, and how can we support families more directly.
So you are working to change your own numbers.
Well, I'm working to, like any prosecutor or anyone who manages an institution, I am working to improve both the fairness and the perception of fairness in our office and to reduce anyone from coming into the justice system unless there is a need to bring them in.
Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi. This is about the Texas law about carrying guns in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of discussion of the Fugitive Slave Act before the Civil War. Southern states kept crying, states' rights, but they got the federal government to enforce their rights over northern states. And
right.
Slaves had to run away to Canada to get away from it.
So for people who don't know what you're talking about, it's something that D.A. Vance has been very active on, the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, now before Congress. You're very much against it.
I am. And listeners, don't glaze over at the sound of Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, because it's actually a really serious issue that may very well affect New Yorkers more than any other city in the country. The act is an act that has now been introduced three times in both houses of the Congress. It's expected to pass the House of Representatives this year, and then the question will be, will it pass the Senate? Brian accurately described it. It's really a lowest common denominator approach to national law and the right to possess concealed weapons in public. It would permit a person who was legally in possession of a concealed weapon in their own state, and 12 states have no rules whatsoever in order to get that permission to take that gun anywhere in the United States and have it be legal. If it was legal to have five concealed weapons on your person, it would be legal to bring those into New York City and Times Square. It's an absurd law. It is one where it's opposed by major police organizations and a group called Prosecutors Against Gun Violence, which is a national coalition of big city DAs that I co-founded with the LA city attorney.
And as the caller suggests, the conservative principle of states' rights only goes so far as when they can impose their values on all the states, like with something like this.
The law is absurd and dangerous in many respects. It's absurd just for your point that you made, Brian. It has always been a conservative mantra that the federal government should not tell states what to do. Now what we're having is the federal government trying to pass laws requiring New York State to adopt the gun laws, for example, of West Virginia. My response is, I wouldn't presume to tell West Virginia what its gun laws should be. They know better, and we know better in New York, having reduced gun violence enormously because of our strict gun laws. We know that the laws of West Virginia are not going to work here in New York and Manhattan, which is the most densely populated county in the country.
I was even thinking about the terrorist attack on the bike path on Halloween and how the attacker got out of his truck after it crashed and waved two small guns in the air, or they weren't real guns. I'm not exactly sure what that was. But it occurred to me that maybe if we didn't have our local gun laws in New York and New Jersey, where he was from, they could have been assault weapons, and it could have been so much worse.
Absolutely. First of all, we just have to commend the NYPD for their response to that incident several weeks ago. And indeed, had the defendant in that case been able to purchase guns, loaded guns, and bring them legally into New York City, then he would have, when he got out of the truck, have actually live ammunition, which could have resulted in a very different outcome.
On the other side, gun rights supporters will say the Texas massacre last week, where the gunman trying to escape, of course he had semi-automatic weapons, was shot by a private citizen who knew who he was. And so the president and others are making the case for more carry permits as a public safety measure for cases like that. What's your response?
Absurd. Absolutely absurd. Imagine having 500 guns concealed in Times Square on any given day. A fender bender starts. The driver who's got a gun pulls out his gun because he's angry. The police arrive on the scene. There's 20 people with guns in their hands. The cops have no idea who is actually the individual that's fault here. The cops are going to be most affected by this law if it's passed, let alone our visitors and our citizens. And what I really ask your listeners to do is to get on the phone, call your congressman or woman and senator and tell them, say no to the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, because it is a dangerous law and dangerous particularly for New York City.
We're over time. Let me get to one other thing real quick. On the new rule in New York State that allows judges to force prosecutors to turn over evidence that would benefit the defendant, you were on a task force that recommended that rule, and you support that rule, I see. Is it a good reminder of the place of prosecutors in the justice system, not just adversaries seeking prosecutions?
I think the order that's proposed by the chief judge, which I supported on the task force on wrongful convictions, it absolutely makes sense. And it makes sense for the very simple reason that we are already obligated to do this, to provide Brady material. So how could one object to a order by the court to do something that the law already requires us to do? But I think, Brian, in the broad context of things, where I think prosecutors should be on an issue like this and on a number of criminal justice issues is to focus on ethical obligations, take the lead in that area, focus on crime prevention strategies, not just who you're putting in jail, but how to invest in communities to keep families together and keep kids out of jail. That's why we are funding 5 youth hubs throughout Manhattan to provide $50 million into those communities to provide local support for families on an array of services that they want and need. It's why we've been funding the rape kit backlog of testing of rape kits all over the country in order to identify who the sexual assault defendants are who have yet to be detained, and to identify them and to prosecute them. Prosecutors really have an opportunity in this environment at this time to lead in a changing way in the criminal justice system, to focus on protecting our communities through a variety of tools we now have at our disposal, not just arrest and jail.
Manhattan DA Cy Vance, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.